Hi, I'm Tony Rossi for The Christophers, and on today's show, I'll cover a harrowing story that dominated news headlines a few years ago. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan will be joining me to discuss a book they co-authored called Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. It tells the story of Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, two of the young women who were kidnapped, held hostage, and abused by school bus driver Ariel Castro for 10 years. Amanda and Gina not only survived the ordeal, they maintained their Christian faith through it all. Stay with us. Christopher Close-Up starts right now. Hello and welcome to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi. Chances are you remember watching the news in May 2013 and seeing the story of three young women who'd escaped a house of horrors in Cleveland in which they'd been held hostage for 10 years. Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, and Michelle Knight were just teenagers when they were abducted by school bus driver Ariel Castro. For 10 years, he held them against their will, often using chains to keep them in his house. The girls were deprived of sufficient food and water. They were raped several times a day, and Amanda became pregnant and gave birth inside the house. Yet through it all, they maintained their faith and spirit of resilience. How did they do it? Washington Post journalists Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan have co-authored a book with Amanda and Gina called Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. To tell us more, I'm happy to welcome to Christopher Close-Up, Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan. Mary and Kevin, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Our pleasure, thank you.
Delighted.
Now, in light of the horrors that Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, and Michelle Knight experienced in Ariel Castro's house, it's curious to me that Amanda and Gina chose to title this memoir Hope, which it would seem to be that was the one quality they needed to get through that. But yet I'm still a little surprised that's what they called it. So why did they choose to call this book Hope?
Well, it's very, you know, we called it Hope for a reason. It's very, very deliberately done. You know, there are tough things that happen to these young women, and they're in the book. I mean, they have to be, or you can't really understand the experience that they went through. But that's not what the book is about. The book is really about the resilience, the strength that these women found and how they endured this and how they never did really lose hope. It was incredible. I mean, you have to remember that these girls were just, it couldn't have been more normal. I mean, Gina was 14 years old and in the seventh grade, and Amanda was 16 years old and worked at a Burger King. These were just like kids from your neighborhood, you know, and they were totally ordinary people who were thrust into this just crazy, difficult situation, and somehow inside themselves, they found this absolutely extraordinary strength to keep on hoping.
I think what it tells us is that when you want to keep going and you're in pain, whatever kind of pain you're going through or tragedy, mm-hmm. that you always want to hope that it will get better.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, human, and it's what got them through this. You know, if they had known the first year that it would be 9 more years,
yeah.
you know, they often talked about, you know, I just can't do this. But it turned out that hoping that the next day would be better than today was clearly the mental life raft that got them through. And one amazing thing was that it helped them just to write the words hope. On the back of the book, there's a stencil that their captor actually got at a yard sale, and it said hope. And they took that and wrote the words over and over and put it on the wall.
Wow.
And it's kind of like when you're down, they say, just smile. Somehow it'll make you feel better.
Yeah.
Just writing the word hope made them feel better.
Wow, that's incredible. What was working on this book for them, was it tough because it was reliving such bad memories, or was it in a way cathartic being able to tell their story?
Well, it was both. I mean, I think at the beginning, especially when we were all just getting to know each other, it was very difficult for them to kind of confront these things. But over time, I think there was an element of catharsis. They did feel like getting this out. They wanted the book to be one record that they could refer people to. You know, people are always saying to them, oh, so, you know, what must that have been like? And they wanted one record that was complete and thorough and honest, where they could say to people, well, read the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan about the book they co-authored with Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus called Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. Early in her ordeal, Amanda writes in the book, I never went to church much, but I know there is a God, and I know he must have a different plan for me than this. And I thought that was an astounding statement, because in light of her ordeal, it would have been understandable for her to doubt the existence of a loving God. What kept her and Gina believing through it all?
Great question. And one, both of them cited their belief in God, that somehow he was going to take care of them and get them out of there. And in fact, Gina, one of the first things she did when she got out, having been in there and through hell for so long, went to church, lit a candle, and said a prayer for all the other missing girls.
Wow.
And she would say, too, that she just felt a presence. Amanda found a little candle with the picture of Jesus on it in the basement, and she would light it and think that after her mother died, she would light this Jesus candle and pray to her mom and have her mom watch over her. And she is completely convinced that it was her mom up in heaven who helped her escape the day, gave her the courage to escape.
Yeah. And there was some remarkable serendipity. I mean, she found that candle, and she also found a photograph, a drawing of Jesus in the basement, too. Castro was a real hoarder, so he had all kinds of stuff. And she just found this thing one day, and it became a real lifeline for her. She put it up in her, you know, beside her bed in the room where she was being held, and it became a real source of strength and hope for her.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned Castro, and you did some research into his background. When someone does something as, I have to call it, evil as he did, you know, we might try to explain it away as mental illness of some kind. Having researched him thoroughly, do you think he was sane, or was he a sociopath? Because even after he was caught, he kept identifying himself as a victim.
Well, I think that, I think Amanda, when she was at some point, was heard the word sociopath on television, and she looked it up, and she said, wow, that's exactly him. And she thought that he told her several times that he had no feelings. She would say, how can you do this to me? How can you do this to me and my family? You can see on TV what you're putting them through. And he would say, I don't feel anything. I just don't feel, I understand that they're hurting, but I don't feel it myself. So I think he was a sociopath. And I think in prison they diagnosed him as a narcissist, which he clearly was. I mean, he obviously thought only about himself, and he didn't care about what his actions did to other people.
You know, one of the things that Amanda came away from this whole 10 years being held captive was the importance of kindness, little kindnesses and big kindnesses to people. And Ariel Castro just didn't have that concept. I mean, I do think there was something clearly wrong with him. When somebody has no empathy, no consideration beyond themselves, there is a problem. But it's interesting that his prisoners came away with just being reinforced by the importance of kindness and looking out for other people and helping other people get through difficult times.
And he was, he was a very multidimensional guy, and we try to present that in the book. We don't just present him with horns and a pitchfork. He, particularly with his daughter. I mean, he was a doting father to his daughter. He treated her very, very well, never harmed her in any way, treated her like a princess, and he adored her, and she loved him. I mean, she didn't know anything else. So that left, Amanda particularly with very conflicted views about him, because for all the awful things that she did, there would be moments when you could see real kindness in him, and that was, confusing and confounding.
I'm talking to Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan about the book they co-authored called Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. I mean, in a way, this is also, in terms of Castro, it's also a tale of domestic violence that he exhibited toward his wife. Is this a common pattern for domestic violence victims, like his wife Nilda? She didn't leave when she had the chance because he threatened to kill her and the kids. Is that a common pattern for these women who are enduring this really difficult decision?
Sadly, it is, and it's an epidemic in the United States. It's probably the thing that gets me so upset and riled because of the numbers. So in this case, Ariel Castro, the person who had kidnapped these girls and kept them in his house, well before that, he had met a woman when they were really young, and they were common law married for a long time. and he just beat her so badly she was in the emergency room many times. I mean, we're talking broken bones, and she ultimately had a brain injury because of him. And she didn't leave him. She would try several times. One time she actually was outside the courthouse trying to get a restraining order, and he came up and threatened her and said, "You go into that courtroom, and I'm going to make you wish you didn't," and threatened her and the kids. And so a lot of the people, especially people with no economic means, I mean, they were poor people. Like, if she left, where was she going to live? You know, she depended on him for money. She didn't want him to do anything to the kids. And this is an all too familiar story. And more has to be done to have resources for women who feel trapped by abusive spouses.
Yeah. Well, I know Castro used chains to imprison the girls, Amanda and Gina and Michelle. How big a factor was also fear in his efforts to keep them in line? Because it sounds like that's what he used with his ex-wife as well.
Yeah, they were terrified of him, and he because he was so unpredictable, they never knew what he was fully capable of. I mean, obviously he had done some terrible things to them, but they were afraid that he could snap and kill them at any point. You know, and for Amanda particularly, this was difficult because she thought, okay, well, if I do something and he kills me, that means my daughter is going to be left to be raised by him.
Yeah,
she couldn't allow that, and it's so complicated, everything in there. And he was an incredibly manipulative guy, and he was very good at it. He, you know, he would tell Amanda that Gina and Michelle were saying terrible things about her, and then he would tell them that Amanda was saying bad things about them. And pretty much, you know, over time, weeks go by and months go by and years go by, and you keep hearing this and you start to believe it. So they could never trust each other enough to sort of band up against him and try to kill him or do something, because he manipulated them so thoroughly.
But your question is fascinating, really, about the chains. So these were rusty old chains, heavy, you know, and in Amanda's case, she writes about how my whole world was 5 feet, because that was the length of the chain.
Mm-hmm.
She was chained to a radiator, and everything she did was around there. Well, years went by, years and years and years, and finally when he took it off, and he only took it off because the little baby who was born in there was starting to get old enough and asked, "Mommy, what's that?"
Mm.
And for a while she would try to deflect and say, "Oh, it's a bracelet," and she'd hide it with a blanket. But Castro didn't want his daughter, who he did love, to realize the insanity of what was going on there, so took it off. And yes, it was the ghost of those chains were still there, because it was always the threat of, "I'll put it back," you know. And
yeah.
So she was kind of frozen and worried that okay, now life is a little bit better. I can walk around, feels better, but at any moment it could get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So after the physical chains came off, there still were certainly kind of the ghost of them all around that house.
Yeah. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan about their book, Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. It's a book co-written with Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, who were held hostage and abused and, I would even say, tortured by a man named Ariel Castro in Cleveland for 10 years until they were finally rescued. You mentioned Amanda's daughter a few times now, and I want to ask about her. Jocelyn's her name, and Jocelyn is the child of Ariel raping Amanda numerous times a day. At least in the beginning, is the impression I got. He would rape these girls several times a day, and Jocelyn is the result. And yet it seems Jocelyn, both when Amanda was pregnant and after the fact, brought some light and again, the word hope, into the lives of these young women. Talk about that a little bit.
She changed everything in that house, because in a lot of ways, the baby made him happier, and when he was happier, everyone was happier. He was better to everybody else. It sort of mellowed him, and he, you know, the girls could see him just enjoying being a father again. Amanda talks a lot about how much it meant to him, and the things that he would say. He would just beam and say, "I can't believe I'm a dad again."
Mm-hmm.
And you know, inside Amanda would be thinking, you know, God, what a sick way of looking at this situation. But, you know, truly, he loved that little girl, and he treated her so well that things just got a little bit lighter in the house, and Jocelyn really, in a lot of ways, saved them from years of even worse torture.
And, you know, truly amazing. That girl today is beautiful and vibrant, smart. She's going to a public school in Cleveland, and it's just a remarkable outcome.
Yeah.
And I think Amanda inside, you know, she said there's many ways to look at this, and I'm not looking at as though she is his child. She is my child.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, and they're extremely close. And Jocelyn is just a marvelous, infectiously happy little girl. It's really one of the miracles of this story. There are several miracles.
Yeah.
It's still alive to begin with.
Absolutely. Well, how did they create that sense of normalcy for her, the three girls together?
Well, you know, Amanda decided early on that she was going to do everything that she could to make Jocelyn feel like she was normal, and that's the word that she kept using over and over again. You know, I should say that we know a lot of this stuff from the fact that Amanda kept 1,200 pages of very detailed diaries.
Mm-hmm.
So there's stuff in there about exactly how much Jocelyn weighed when she was a week old and a month old and how tall she was and her first words and her favorite food. So we can write with great specificity about this, and it helped us understand the situation so well, and then we could use it to, you know, we'd say to Amanda or Gina, you know, we found this in the diary, and what did you mean? And we were able to use it as a reporting tool, but all through the diary, the word normal shows up. And Amanda, you know, probably our favorite story from the book is when Jocelyn was old enough to start kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda decided that she was going to put her in kindergarten. So she took, you know, junk mail and flyers that had been put under the front door and all that kind of stuff. She would cut out photos of food and shapes and numbers and animals, and she pasted them up in her bedroom where she was chained to the bed, and made a little classroom out of it. Castro got her a little table and chair at a yard sale and a whiteboard, and she started having kindergarten classes on the regular school schedule. She
Wow.
would take weekends off, she would take holidays off, and every morning she would start the class the way that she did when she was a little girl. She would say to Jocelyn, "Please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance." And the two Mm-hmm. of them would stand together with their hands over their hearts, and they would say the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's amazing. And it just it reminds me of, because, I mean, early on in the book, Amanda says, "I think about killing myself, but if I do, he wins," which to me is kind of a sign of a real spirit of defiance. And that spirit of defiance seemed to grow even greater once Jocelyn was born, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and everything was working towards making this girl normal, and one day we're going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
One day I'm just going to walk down the street, we're going to go get an ice cream cone. And it was really all the little things that she was really focused on when she was hoping to get out. She was just hoping to be with her sister. Her mother died, unfortunately, while she was inside.
Right.
But her sister was there, and she would talk about going to the lake with her daughter and flying a kite and getting an ice cream. And it is, even to this day, now they've been 2 years out, what they're really kind of bask in is the everyday joys of life, of feeling sun on your face, feeling a breeze, being able to walk to the refrigerator and eat, you know, anything you want when you want, and not being in a room waiting for someone to give you scraps.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a recent picture of Gina and Amanda in the book, and their smiles are so bright and genuine. I was going to ask you, have they really rediscovered the ability to feel joy? But I think you just answered that question, is yes, they have.
Yes.
They absolutely have. And in the smallest things, as Mary was saying, you know, the feel of sunshine on their face, the feel of water on their toes in the lake, any little thing just makes them, they're so appreciative of it.
And, you know, they're so young. I mean, they're only in their 20s. I mean, the great thing here is, I mean, they've lived many lives and had such difficulty, but they're still in their 20s. It's a lot of life ahead.
Absolutely. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan about the book they co-authored with Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus called Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. And I have to admit, I think like a lot of people, I got goosebumps reading the part of the book when they were finally rescued. How is that you know, writing that for you? How was the experience for them? And just the whole, the neighborhood coming together? Because it seems like the community kept alive the hope that they would somehow be found alive over this 10 years, which is almost unheard of.
It's funny. That scene is actually one of the very first things that we wrote. Because when we first met Amanda and Gina, you know, we didn't want to dive right into all the, you know, the terrible things that happened. So we said, wow, that, you know, we all saw that escape. Tell us about that. So that was really the first thing that we learned about. And it was just remarkable how they found the strength to do that. You know, Castro was very, very careful about always leaving doors locked in the house. You know, he would lock the girls into their room whenever he left. When he was home, sometimes he'd leave the door open so they could have a little bit, they could go downstairs and use the toilet, for example. But Jocelyn came up into her room and said to her mom, you know, Daddy's gone. And Amanda just froze and couldn't believe that could possibly be true. And she said, no, he must be here. Go look around some more. And Jocelyn looked, and she peeked out into the driveway and saw that his car was gone. And as soon as Amanda realized that he was actually gone, this was the first time in 10 years that he had messed up on his security regimen. So she went to the top of the stairs and froze and thought he must be downstairs someplace waiting to trick her to see if she would actually try to escape, because he was that kind of devious guy. And eventually she just ran. She ran to the front door and she pulled it open. She peeled away the locks and she got it open and she thought, I'm free. And that's when she realized there was a storm door outside that was closed with a chain and a padlock. Eventually they got out, but it was just a terrifying moment for them, and they never really felt safe even when they were out until they were sitting in the back of a police cruiser.
Yeah. Well, at least from what I can, my research, this is the first book the two of you have written since your previous book, which won a Christopher Award, called The Prison Angel, about Mother Antonia Brenner. Was there some kind of thematic connection between the, because a lot of years have passed between you writing and this, between that book and this book. What made you kind of get to the point of wanting to do that again?
That's a great question. I mean, Mother Antonia, who was one of the most amazing people, what a strong woman who started a whole ministry in a prison in Mexico and changed thousands of lives for the better. She, because of her, literally thousands of very poor people, many of them who were in jail, were better off. Mm-hmm. Here in Cleveland, it was two women that we thought we could help. You know, I'm from that same part of Cleveland. You know, I didn't grow up with Lot either. And we thought that we could help them tell their story. And, you know, the money for the book goes to them. Mm. And I think through that, a great satisfaction for us was walking down the street with Gina the other day, and another woman crossed over and up to Gina and said, you know, I know you from the news and you don't know me, but I had this really terrible thing happen to me. And because I read your story and saw that you can get through it and keep on going, I'm going to get through what's going on with me. I think she had also had a sexual assault. And boy, is that satisfying that this story is helping other people realize that really bad things, through no fault of your own, can happen to you, and you can keep going. And Mother Antonia, certainly, that was a story that she told every single day in Mexico to people.
And she was, you know, Mother Antonia has been such a huge part of our life ever since the day we met her, you know, which was, I guess, 10, 12, 13 years ago now. And she died last year, and she died the same week that we signed the contract to do this book. And we just had to believe that Mother Antonia was helping us out there somehow.
Right.
In fact, we kept her picture above the computer in our room where we were working on the book.
Yeah. Well, in our closing moments, you know, it's the motto of the Christophers. It's on the Christopher Awards. You have better to light one candle than to curse the darkness. How do you think this book, Hope, reflects that motto?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, if you read the book, these girls do not curse the darkness. They are all about what's forward, you know, what's coming in the future and how things are going to get better and their plans. And, you know, the book is all about how they defeated Castro, but they don't dwell on it. And we try not to, you know, it's there, but we don't, it's just, they don't wallow in it. They're hopeful people who want the future to be better and who know the future is going to be better. And in the, you know, the 2 years that they've been out, they've already made just incredible strides in their life, and they've really you can see, you can feel the optimism coming off these people. So they really are. They are lighting candles with their lives every day.
And I think that, you know, you can come out of really difficult things either bitter and broken or hopeful and looking forward to the next day. And this is a real concrete example of how you can do that. When they wake up, they are so happy to be still young and free and loving life. And that's the first thing that they would say. They're just very hopeful about what tomorrow is going to be for them.
Right. Are they making plans for the future for themselves, whether school or career?
Yes, they're going to finish their high school. You know, it's amazing. They were only 14 and 16 when they were picked up. So they have to first finish their high school. They're both interested in fashion. Gina is going to go to New York, and she hopes one day maybe she could have a little store selling clothes. Amanda has a gift for teaching. She taught her daughter. Mm. She's a very good student. I wouldn't be surprised at all if she does that. And both of them want to be advocates for other missing kids and to help them and help their parents. All kinds of kids in trouble.
Right. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I've been talking to Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan about their book, Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. It tells the tale of Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, who were held hostage for 10 years by Ariel Castro, abused by him, tortured by him. But yet they came out still holding on to hope. There's just a line I want to read from Amanda after she got out. She writes, "For 10 years, I lived in a world controlled by one selfish man. Now I live in a world of kindness where total strangers help me and ask for nothing in return." This book is a beautiful testimony to hope. Amanda and Gina are both great testimonies to hope. So please pick up Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. And Mary and Kevin, thanks for writing the book, and thanks for sharing your story with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, before we end today's show, here's a message the Christophers would like to share with you.
Every once in a while, we come face to face with someone who has borne the weight of the world on their shoulders without losing hope or crumbling under the pressure. How are some people able to cope in circumstances that would debilitate the rest of us? The short answer is that their perseverance is grounded in faith. That's why the Christophers have prepared a news note called Persevering Through Pain and Struggle. It shares stories and reflections that will help you endure challenging times by relying on the promise of God's love. To request your free copy of Persevering Through Pain and Struggle, send an email to radio@christophers.org or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
In closing, I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and I encourage you to visit our website at christophers.org to learn more about the Christophers and to download free literature and podcasts. When you're there, you can also find links to our blog and our Facebook and Twitter pages. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to radio@christophers.org. Our engineer for today's show is Brian Bonifacio, and I'm Tony Rossi, your host. Thanks again for joining us, and remember that it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness.